Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, February 24th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas. Ahead, the types of food establishments, restaurants, convenience stores, groceries, fast food businesses that surround a school have an impact on childhood obesity. That's according to a study conducted by researchers at the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture. We'll speak with the two of them on this edition of Ozarks. Also, Roby Brock has his Talk Business Arkansas update. Becca Martin Brown has What's Up and more. But first, the Arkansas House of Representatives on Friday failed to get a 3/4 majority vote to pass funding for the state's private option alternative to Medicaid expansion. It was the fourth time last week the House could not reach 75 votes, falling short with 71 for and 18 against. On the House floor, Republican Representative Mark Lowry, who cast his yes vote on the private option for the first time this fiscal session, called the program an open-ended work order.
We have an imperfect bill, whether you like it or whether you're opposed to it. Even those that like it would have to admit that it is imperfect. It is a compromise. And the bottom line definition of the word compromise is that both sides lose. It's lose-lose. That's fine for corporations, and that's fine for people negotiating deals, but you know, we're here to represent the people of the state of Arkansas.
Lowry went on to say that he supports the private option because it will help poor working people afford more in life and contribute more to the state's economy. Meanwhile, House Speaker Davy Carter continued to say enough votes are there to pass the private option, and further negotiations are off the table.
The reality is, this is the bill. There aren't enough votes to amend the bill, to send it back to budget, to do anything different. So that's just the reality. And it's time that we deal with this because we've got a whole other, we have a lot of other bills to deal with. I mean, we have to set a budget for this entire state.
The House is expected to vote again when it reconvenes tomorrow afternoon. The state Senate approved the legislation Thursday. While the fate of the private option awaits another vote tomorrow, some results of a different health care program in Arkansas, the Arkansas Payment Improvement Initiative, are out. In his weekly radio address, Governor Mike Beebe said the plan has insurers pay for episodes of care rather than individual treatments or tests.
The initiative rewards health care providers who furnish patients with high-quality care at appropriate costs. Most of our Medicaid clients are now in a patient-centered medical home where the primary care clinician has assumed responsibility for improving quality and managing costs. For select conditions, performance is measured in different episodes of care, which encompass the treatment a patient receives for a particular illness or disease from the time of first diagnosis through recovery.
The program has been in existence since 2012. The Libertarian Party of Arkansas held its nominating convention this weekend in Little Rock. After extensive signature gathering efforts, the party is on the statewide ballot. Jessica Paxton, chairman of the Libertarian Party, says a number of candidates were nominated Saturday.
We nominated 26 candidates today that will be on the ballot all over the state of Arkansas come November. Nominated a candidate for U.S. Senate, for all four congressional districts, for all seven constitutional offices. That's governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, treasurer, auditor, and land commissioner. And we also nominated candidates for several state house races, justice of the peace, constable, and county judge.
Paxton says the party expects to perform better in smaller races, where the disadvantage libertarians face in fundraising will be minimized. As with most third parties in Arkansas, the contest for governor is crucial. If their nominee, Frank Gilbert, garners 3% of the vote, the party will automatically be placed on the ballot next election without requiring an extensive and expensive signature gathering effort. Bentonville will soon move forward with improvements to some paved areas at the Bentonville Municipal Airport. The city's Airport Advisory Board on Friday approved a plan to improve the airport's runway safety area. Ben Peters, Bentonville city engineer, says that the improvements won't involve work on the actual paved runway surface.
There's an area that's required on both sides and at each end of the runway to be within tolerances for grades and slopes in case a plane were to slip off the pavement one side or the other or run off the end. And that's what we're doing. The current runway safety area doesn't quite meet the specifications. It's a little too steep in some areas. And so we'll be regrading the ground around the runway to meet those criteria.
The project will cost the city a little less than $550,000 and the work is expected to be completed in 90 days, with 7.5-hour workdays during which the runway will be closed. Peters says that the runway safety improvements are needed before any other improvements can be made at the airport. Peters says that other safety projects, like perimeter fencing, are improvements likely to follow once the runway safety project is complete. The Razorback baseball team is still undefeated after the weekend series against Eastern Illinois. Arkansas swept the Panthers in the 3-game set at Baum Stadium. The Razorbacks continue the season opening 10-game homestand with 3 games against South Alabama beginning Friday, followed by a Monday afternoon game against Indiana-Purdue-Fort Wayne. Increasing clouds this evening with overnight lows from 32 in northwest Arkansas to 40 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Tuesday, cloudy with a high near 48 in northwest Arkansas and cloudy with a 20% of showers and a high of 56 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, mostly cloudy with a low of 19 in northwest Arkansas and a 20% chance of showers and a low of 26 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Habitat for Humanity Washington County is celebrating the construction of the state's first habitat home seeking LEED certification. The organization scheduled a dedication of the home for yesterday afternoon, and Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
I want to thank everybody for being here. It's exciting for a number of reasons. This is home number 50 for Habitat for Humanity Washington County.
Last Thursday morning, a small group gathered inside a bright yellow two-story home in Salem Village, a neighborhood located just west of Holcomb Elementary in Fayetteville. Members of the Chamber of Commerce, dressed in purple blazers, gathered for a ribbon-cutting ceremony at Habitat for Humanity, Washington County's latest constructed home. Executive Director Jason Kendall says this is the 50th home the organization has constructed since it was founded in 1991.
It's a nice number. You know, you build 10, 15 houses in a few years, and you know, you're still just getting started. And once you hit that 50 mark, it's kind of like you've got some longevity. You know, we've got a nice reputation now. And we've got a nice family of homeowners that are behind us at this point. So that's kind of what we look at is, you know, we can look backwards and we've had a lot of successes we can learn from and a few things, you know, that we can point to and say, well, we'd like to do that differently. And we can kind of take all that experience moving forward. So to us, it just kind of proves that we're here to stay and have been for a while.
The new home, which is a little more than 1,300 square feet, is also seeking LEED certification. If everything checks out, it will be the first LEED-certified Habitat for Humanity home in the state. According to the U.S. Green Building Council, LEED, or Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, is a program that provides third-party verification of green buildings. Projects satisfy prerequisites and earn points to achieve different levels of certification. When points are finally added up, Kendall believes it will be close, but that they will have enough to reach the gold level of certification, the third tier in the four-tier ranking. Buildings are classified as certified, silver, gold, or platinum, with platinum requiring the most points. Mark Cloud is a LEED accredited professional who helped work on this project. He is the owner of Integrated Solutions Group and the former chair of the U.S. Green Building Council for the state of Arkansas. He explains there are some costs associated with applying for LEED certification. However, in instances like this one, professionals are sometimes willing to donate their time because if they want to become a LEED accredited professional, one of the requirements is working on a LEED project. There is a one-time registration fee for LEED certification, and for a single home, the fee is $225. However, Cloud says the local chapter of the council agreed to pay for Habitat for Humanity's fee. When working on a project like this, Cloud says a phrase to keep in mind is people, planet, profit.
The people part of it is healthier to live in. The profit part is the energy. You know, we reduce the amount of water you use by both low flow water faucets and showers and toilets and stuff, and also by capturing rainwater on site to use instead of tap water for that. And then And then the planet is obviously when we build something, you know, usually wood and all the materials that you use have to come from somewhere. And so a lot of what Lee does is promote things that both are durable, so they don't have to be replaced. Also, they're more native, more natural to the environment.
To help with some of these goals, all of the appliances are ENERGY STAR rated. A foam insulation helps lock in the hot or cold air, depending on the time of the year. Lower flow plumbing fixtures have been installed, and the house was decorated with low VOC paint. Cloud says VOC stands for volatile organic compound, and these types of paints release fewer gases into the air than regular paint. While working on this project, Jason Kendall, Habitat for Humanity Washington County's executive director, says they really wanted to buck the myth that it was expensive to build a LEED certified home. He says it can be expensive if you want it to be, but they were really careful and were able to build this home within $5,000 to $10,000 of what it costs to build their other homes. He says they're really proud of that, and it worked out so well for them that they intend to build LEED certified homes moving forward.
You know, going for a LEED certified Habitat home, of course, it's, you know, it's nice publicity because nobody's done it before. But what it really comes down to in the end is you've got a home that's healthier to live in, because you don't have, you know, off-gassing from paints and carpets and things like that. There's little to no waste involved in the construction of the home. But the really nice part is the cost to the homeowner is lower in the long run.
That's because they don't lose so much of their monthly income to energy expenses. When you walk into the new home, the floor is made of polished concrete. Kendall says it's a new trend in home construction, and it comes with benefits. For example, it's easier to clean than carpet, a material that needs replaced after time and whose glue often produces fumes. Kendall says while there is carpeting that does meet LEED certification standards, it's more expensive. All of the appliances have been donated, and the kitchen countertops are comprised of a synthetic material that was made from recycled plastic. The wooden bar top is made from the flooring of an 18-wheeler that was donated from a company in Harrison. After pointing out these items, Kendall explains points are awarded in the LEED program for using repurposed and recycled material. The three-bedroom, two-bath home is split between two levels. While they don't typically construct two-story homes, Kendall says they agreed to it because of the good deal they got on the lots in this neighborhood.
Our goal is to get people out of substandard housing and get them into safe, affordable housing, and we always say safe first. So, you know, for example, we might have lots donated, and when I take a call on lots to be donated, first call I make is to my board, tell them where it is, see if they know anything about it. Then I call the police, and we look at crime records for the area. Go with gut feeling. I'm kind of a gut feeling guy. And usually after, you know, going through that process, we'll know if we want to take the lot or not. I've actually turned down some lots here recently for donation. Kind of hated to do that, but I knew it wasn't going to lift any of our families out of situations they were in. So we look for lots that are donated. We do purchase lots. These were all purchased. We got a great deal on them, but they were purchased. We usually look for places that we could build in without covenants that are just going to be added cost. You know, if they're covenants that make sense for safety and things like that, not a problem. But if it's, you know, extensive covenants that are just going to add cost, we might stay away from it.
A home they finished building last spring is located next door. The lot to the west of the new home is where they'll break ground on another house in the fall. Kendall says they average about two homes a year, and of course that varies based on a number of factors like weather. They broke ground on the two-story yellow home in August, and weather was one of the factors that made construction take a little longer than usual. Kendall says the original plan was to move the homeowner and her grandson into their new home by Christmas, but now they're hoping to have a final inspection completed in time to move them in by the 1st of March. The landscaping of the home has some features that are just as interesting as those inside. Kendall says the plants are native plants. Some of the landscaping includes shade trees to help shade the house and minimize soil erosion. There are also plans to install a system that will capture rainwater that can be used to water the plants. Kendall says they have been working with the homeowner for a couple of years now and says this is not a fast process or a quick fix. Instead, he says it's more of an investment in the partner families because of the education and work that's involved. Although the process of becoming a homeowner can take a while, he says they're there for the families for the long haul.
I think it's important for folks to note that we don't give houses away. That's a misconception. We actually are, we call ourselves a compassionate mortgage company. In addition to a resale store and a construction firm, we are a mortgage company. We hold our own mortgages. Our homeowners purchase the homes from us, but it's 0% interest. That's the big deal. And along with that, there's a lot of hand-holding, and you know, we're just not somebody they just send a mortgage check to. They meet with us. We see them face-to-face a lot. We help them through difficulties down the road.
For more on this organization, you can visit HabitatWashingtonCOAR.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Just ahead on Ozarks at Large, Arkansas has some of the highest obesity rates among adults and children in the United States. A duo of researchers is looking at the effects food environment has on the body mass indices of children.
The end of the school day is probably a time when a lot of children are fairly hungry. And it may not be that they can get off the bus and go get you know, fast food or something of that nature, but it does say, gosh, that looks really good. You know, so it may be more something that occurs on other occasions. It's just it may almost be a marketing stimulus around the schools is one potential mechanism.
We'll have more in just over 20 minutes here on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, what's happening to kids' school data? A lot of educators are concerned.
This new system is going to allow the collection of student suspension records by name. This system does not afford the same protection to children's privacy as our criminal justice system.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
It begins next after Ozarks at Large on 91.3 FM.
Walmart's profits took a tumble last week, and other Arkansas companies report their profits. Roby Brock with our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, has more in this Talk Business and Politics update.
Revenues grew modestly, but profits took a tumble as Walmart reported its fourth quarter and full year financials. The Bentonville-based retail giant reported fourth quarter net income of $4.4 billion on sales of more than $128 billion. Last year, Walmart posted fourth quarter profits of $5.8 billion. For the full year, Walmart posted net income of $16 billion on revenue of $476 billion. However, full year profits were down 5.7% compared to nearly $17 billion 1 year ago. Murphy USA, the retail spinoff of Murphy Oil Corporation, posted fourth quarter profits of $93 million on revenue of more than $4 billion. For the full year, El Dorado-based Murphy USA posted net income of $235 million on revenue of $18 billion. America's Car-Mart posted lower earnings as charge-offs and competition reduced net income in its most recent quarter. The Bentonville-based Buy Here, Pay Here used car dealer reported third quarter net income of almost $1.5 million on revenue of more than $122 million. CJRW, Cranford Johnson Robinson Woods, Arkansas's largest advertising, marketing, and public relations firm, has named Darren Gray as president of the firm. Wayne Woods will continue to serve as chairman and CEO. Gray will assume his duties immediately and will continue to live in Northwest Arkansas, where the agency has an office location. CJRW is headquartered in downtown Little Rock. A $58 million investment from the Fort Smith Regional Healthcare Foundation and a grant of 200 acres from the Fort Chaffee Redevelopment Authority will lead to Arkansas's first osteopathic medical school. The medical school, which will be one of only 31 in the U.S., is estimated to have a $100 million annual economic impact on the region. Doctors of osteopathy medicine, commonly known as DOs, can perform some of the services of a primary care physician, which rural areas of Arkansas and the nation are lacking. The Arkansas Lottery is seeing a trajectory of lower revenue, and commission members charged with its oversight are searching for turnaround solutions. The State Lottery Commission on Wednesday adopted a revised budget forecast that lowers projected net proceeds for the current fiscal year from $89.5 million to just under $83 million. Lottery officials said declining scratch-off ticket sales and a raffle game that lost money were primarily to blame. And in politics, Heber Springs Mayor Jackie McPherson announced Thursday that he would run as a Democrat for the first congressional district seat, challenging two-term incumbent Congressman Rick Crawford, a Republican. McPherson, a self-described fiscal conservative, has served as mayor of Heber Springs since 2007 after serving on the city council for 12 years. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large comes from AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. It is Monday, February 24th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and with me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So there's a happy little play going on at the University of Arkansas.
Spring Awakening.
Spring Awakening resumes Wednesday for the rest of its run through next Sunday. It's a rock musical. It won Tonys for Best Musical, Best Book, and Best Score. The music is by Duncan Sheik. And the words are by Stephen Sater, who was at the Mount Sequoia New Play Retreat in Fayetteville many moons ago.
I've never seen this, but I have listened to the music, and the music is good.
And the play is depressing, but really also moving and fascinating and well worth seeing. It's based on a German play from the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Which makes it fascinating in itself because it was a German play that touches on abortion and homosexuality and rape and child abuse and suicide. Again, not an easy play, but a play well worth seeing. And if you remember Stephen Sater, a little piece of Fayetteville connected to it, too. Showtimes are 8 o'clock Wednesday through Saturday and 2 o'clock on Sunday, and tickets for adults are $16.
All right. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This Week in This American Life. There was this weird story about a year ago, you may have seen this. A guy who was vaguely linked to the Boston Marathon bombings was shot in Florida by the FBI. He was an unarmed man, shot 7 times in his own living room by federal agents. Then the FBI started doing a bunch of things that did not make the news. What really happened? Why were they even in that room with that guy? A reporter spent 5 months looking into it. What she learned this week.
Listen Sunday at 10 a.m. to 91.3 FM.
Last summer, a bit of lost history was revealed in North Dakota. Oil and gas construction had revealed a stone site that, upon further inspection, included stone effigies, lodges, and ceremonial areas of Native American people. Two of the researchers who helped identify the site are on the University of Arkansas campus this evening, as this semester's Stigler Lecture Series featured speakers. This morning, Jennifer L. Hardy and Cade M. Ferris came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about their work.
Cade's actually the one that noticed them, a couple of smaller stone circles, and right outside were what we call fire-cracked rock. It was rock that's been heated to the point where it breaks and shatters. And Bruce and Cade had seen that before in sweat lodges, and even in modern sweats that they still conduct in the same manner that they have in the past. You always have this circle of stone and then the discarded rock outside and a fire pit in the middle, and that's what we found over there. So right away we kind of knew there was more going on here than just people living day to day.
Yeah, and I think that's what was really great is having the tribes out in the field with the archaeologists, which is not a common occurrence, but we were able to bring together that tribal wisdom along with the scientific tools to really make sense of this site in a whole new way that, you know, really is groundbreaking in that sense.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing here. You've got up-to-date, nearly cutting-edge technology, but you have institutional memory of the Native American people there.
Right, and I think that's where we're really trying to, as a company, as archaeologists, Jennifer and myself, we're trying to bring in that tribal perspective, which tends to be overlooked or often seen as an impediment to the process, because it's not an impediment. It's something to enrich the science, I think.
And while when we moved on to the last portion of the site, there were a lot of anomalies out there that, you know, we kind of pointed out, and as we were going along, we were putting a stake in the middle of every feature, which, you know, so each of the stone circles is a feature. The effigies are each a feature. And we noticed that we had some more turtles and some odd-looking things that we weren't quite sure what it was. The grass was up to 2 feet tall in places, so it was hard to see. But we flagged out everything that we thought should be shot in. And as we were going through, we noticed in one area there were stone circles that had a large, almost boulder, a very large stone right in the middle of it. And Bruce said, I think this is important here. This is something. And we were like, well, okay. And he was walking around and he said, this might be a constellation. And, you know, to be honest, my initial reaction was, come on.
You need skepticism in your job, right?
Well, especially when you're looking at you know, the ground with, you know, 2 foot tall grass and a lot of we have a lot of glacial erratic material. So that's what they were making the stone circles out of, was this naturally occurring rock that were being formed into these, you know, human constructed designs. And so your first impression is always going to be, well, it's just random, especially some of these larger boulders, which would have been a fairly Herculean task to move into a design like that.
To appease Bruce, we had the surveyor shoot everything in that he was pointing out as being a potential constellation. And Kate and I were both kind of like, oh, we'll do it, but, you know, it's not going to be anything. And we continued on and finished the fieldwork portion. And then when we got back to the office, Cade was actually doing the data download and looking at everything. And he called me over one day. He's like, oh, my God, you got to come over here. You're not going to believe it. And I went over and looked on the screen, and I was like, no way.
What did you have on that screen?
It's the constellation Cygnus, which occurs between early May and October of every year in the Northern Hemisphere. And according to the Ojibwe, the Chippewa people, it signifies, when it starts coming in May, the return of the birds, the waterfowl from down south. And, of course, in October, it leaves again, and so it's considered the great thunderbird, which brings in all the other birds. And so it has a real significance in, you know, culturally, because it signifies summer. And also that thunderbird effigy or that thunderbird motif figures really prominently in a lot of the Ojibwe ceremonies. And we also found other ceremonial lodges at this site. And so it made perfect sense. Plus, Jennifer found another thunderbird effigy that was directly across from it that you wouldn't have seen otherwise in that tall grass.
Jennifer L. Hardy and Kate M. Ferris talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums this morning about their work in North Dakota, researching a site uncovered last year. Their talk is part of the University of Arkansas's Department of Anthropology-sponsored Stigler Lecture Series and will begin tonight at 6:30 in Giffel's Auditorium inside Old Main on the U of A campus. Their talk is free and open to the public. We'll hear more from their conversation on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
There was a little ship that sailed upon the sea, and the name of that ship was the Mary Golden Tree.
Almeda James Riddle was born November 21st, 1898, in Cleburne County, and educated by her parents. Her father, who sang, taught Almeda to read music before she could read books. Even as a child, she collected songs, especially when her father became a grocer near the local railroad station and she met people from all around. Almeda's practice of ballad collecting continued even when she married H. Price Riddle as a teenager in 1916. The couple had 4 children when in 1926 a tornado killed her husband and the youngest child. Almeda's songbook of the ballad she'd collected for years was also lost. And for the next quarter century, she raised her children as a single mother. In the early 1950s, interest in American folk music was on the rise, and a neighbor introduced Almeda Riddle to John Quincy Wolfe, an instructor from Southwestern in Memphis in the emerging field of folklore study. Wolfe, in turn, introduced Almeda Riddle to Alan Lomax, who in October 1959 recorded her in Greer's Ferry, Arkansas, as well as others in the Mountain View area, on the suggestion of Jimmy Driftwood, whose father, Neil Morris, was among those captured on tape. Almeda Riddle's Mary Golden Tree, heard here and recorded by Lomax that fall, is a tragic tale of a lad who sinks a pirate ship, only to be duped by his own captain. The ballad dates from the 1700s and was lyrically altered by Riddle, a practice said to be more common among Ozark songsters than their counterparts elsewhere.
This world is so sad, and I've grown weary of weeping for the only one I love. But then I know I never will see him until we meet in heaven above.
Riddle sang a cappella and did not consider herself an entertainer. She said a singer should not get in the way of a song, but just stand back. She was a stickler for the ballad form, which originated in the Middle Ages and continued even with European settlement in North America. Bury Me Beneath the Willow, heard here, was likely composed in the second half of the 19th century and was recorded by the Carter family in the 1930s. Almeda Riddle lived her life in Cleburne and White counties, but traveled the nation, singing her ballads at universities and at seminars at Harvard, UCLA, and beyond. Her goal to preserve as many of the old songs as possible for a younger generation was fulfilled. Almeda Riddle died June 30, 1986, with no count on the number of historic ballads she preserved or on the number of lives she influenced. Here in its entirety is Down in Arkansas, recorded in October 1959 in Greer's Ferry and sung by Almeda Riddle of Cleburne County, Arkansas.
Now I've got a gal and her name is Phil. She's down in Arkansas. But I loved her once, I love her still, but she's down in Arkansas. Now she is cross-eyed, that's a fact, but she's down in Arkansas. She cries and the tears roll down her back, but she's down in Arkansas. Down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas. The only gal I've ever loved is down in Arkansas. Now a plumb funny wedding happened the other day. 'Twas down in Arkansas. A gal named Oates married a boy named Hay. 'Twas down in Arkansas. Then the organ played in a minor key down in Arkansas. They played What Will That Harvest Be Now down in Arkansas. Down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas. They played What Will the Harvest Be down in Arkansas. She was cutting hay while the north wind blows down in Arkansas. The sickle slipped and it cut off her nose down in Arkansas. The doctor put it on, but upside down, down in Arkansas. Now when it rains, she almost drowns, down in Arkansas. Down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas, down in Arkansas. The only girl I'll ever love is down in Arkansas.
Cleburne County, Arkansas native Almeda Riddle singing Down in Arkansas, recorded October 1959 by Alan Lomax in Greer's Ferry, Arkansas. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. This is Ozarks at Large. Childhood obesity has been at issue for decades, but it was brought to the forefront in 2010 when First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Let's Move initiative to help combat the issue through education. Two agricultural economists at the Division of Agriculture for the University of Arkansas are bringing the initiative home to the state of Arkansas, where there are some of the highest obesity rates in the nation. Their research surrounds food environment and its effect on childhood obesity. Michael Thompson and Rudy Niga looked at the food available around public schools in Arkansas related to the body mass indices of those students in those schools. They found that students in food deserts often exhibited a higher BMI. According to Thompson and Niga, a food desert is an area where residents don't have access to an abundance of the types of foods necessary for a healthy diet. The USDA began working with food deserts in its 2008 Farm Bill. A food desert, according to the USDA, is an area with no supermarkets within a mile for an urban area, and no supermarkets within 10 miles for a rural area. There's also an income criteria in which the area must be low income. The definition doesn't take into account gated communities that do not have a grocery store nearby.
So they're low-income areas with low access is essentially the two criteria. And we are doing work on that. We're you mentioned Michelle Obama's initiatives. Well, the state of Arkansas has been very serious about obesity and childhood obesity in particular, and that's our focus. In our case, Dr. Naga and I are looking at food deserts surrounding school children in Arkansas, and we're seeing the impact on BMI outcomes. We're working closely with the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement in Little Rock, and we're using the Arkansas BMI data, matching that up with supermarkets in the state, and seeing the effect of food deserts on public school children.
Arkansas schools are required to collect data on the height and weight of their kids. Why is it that they are supposed to monitor that?
Well, it's a screening, and the state legislature passed some legislation in 2003 to initiate those screenings, and the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement is the repository for that information. And, you know, of course, that information is very sensitive, and we don't know whose information it is or anything whenever we work with the data. And that's one reason we go to Little Rock, is it's a secure data room. That data is kept very confidential. At the same time, it does allow unique studies to be done. This is some work that can be done in Arkansas that can't be done anywhere else in the country.
It's confidential. But you do know which schools the information is coming from.
In fact, that is not what we know. The data we work with, we don't even know the school.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. How do you determine, I guess, you know, your whole study is based on, you know, whether or not kids that are in a school in a food desert or go to a school in a food desert are obese or not. So how do you determine?
Very good question. The way this works is we have information on the food environment. The Arkansas Center for Health Improvement has a mechanism by which they can match that data to the children, and then that's blinded. So they do know the school. They do know, you know, other identifiers, but we never see them. Okay. So that's why it's a very important collaboration, because this is something that our work with them allows us to do. So they do the matching, and you know, we know the features that we need to know, but it's in a way that nobody could ever be identified.
How do you determine what the environment is around a particular school? I mean, are you driving to, I don't know, Chester, Arkansas to go stake out what's around?
We bought a database from a private company that includes data on where all the food stores are and the restaurants are around the state. And they've archived this data from 2004. And so we have data on all the different types of food stores and restaurants that are in the state since 2004. And all of these data are geocoded, so we know exactly where they're located. And we've double-checked the existence of a lot of these stores and restaurants for accuracy in the past couple of years.
Are you looking at, I mean, the types of grocery stores? I mean, maybe an Aldi as opposed to a Harps or?
Yes. So in one of our analysis, we actually want to know what's the impact of the density of different types of food stores and different types of restaurants as well on childhood obesity in Arkansas. So we can separate the effect of supermarkets versus convenience stores versus dollar stores. So we have that capability in our data set.
Well, the age of the children that you're looking at, they're not necessarily old enough to skip third period and walk across the street and buy a cheeseburger. So how is it related, I guess?
We're looking around the school, but also, you know, around residences. So it's density in both the home environment and the school environment. But, you know, considering, for example, elementary school, your example, could fast food restaurants have an impact? And if you think about it, fast food is heavily marketed to children. Often signage in the restaurants reinforces that marketing message and, you know, brand symbols and so forth.
Well, even like Hardee's, it's like a star.
Well,
kid friendly.
And, yeah. The other issue is that the end of the school day is probably a time when a lot of children are fairly hungry. And it may not be that they can get off the bus and go get, you know, fast food or something of that nature. But it does say, gosh, that looks really good. You know, so it may be more something that occurs on other occasions. It may almost be a marketing stimulus around the schools is one potential mechanism. The other mechanism is, you know, many children are driven to and from school and, you know, increases, for lack of a better word, pester power, so to speak. You know, can we stop there to a mom or a dad who's taking the children to or from school? So it's the environmental influence, and yes, parents do play a big role. But you know, the parents have opportunities if the establishments are there.
So you have found that there is an increased, more children are obese in schools where there's a McDonald's right next door.
Yeah, we found a positive association between the number of fast food restaurants surrounding a school and the obesity rates in the school. But we're also doing some analysis now at the individual level where we want to know the impact of densities of restaurants and food stores surrounding the residents of the school children.
Do you find when a child is obese that often their parents are obese as well?
Well, in our previous work, we've found a strong correlation. We don't know yet if it's causal, but there's definitely a strong correlation between the BMI of the parents and the BMI of their children.
What, I mean, a child is growing. How do you define whether or not, how do you determine whether or not a child is obese or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. For adults, you know, there's pretty standard guidelines. Mm-hmm. If you have a BMI of this or that number, right. You know, and it's fairly straightforward to calculate. For children, the fact that they are growing is key. And so what we use is actually normalized BMIs. They're called BMI Z scores. And essentially what that is, it's a growth chart-based measure, and it's age-specific and it's gender-specific. And so those the outcome measure we're analyzing is a Z-score that has controlled for age and for gender. And these are based off reference population statistics that enter from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Well, you also looked at when kids move into or out of a food desert area, right?
Our food desert study, that was kind of the empirical strategy, was seeing when children move into or out of, or when their residence changes to or from by virtue of a store opening or closing. So we did kind of a before-after type study. Now, there's other approaches where we're looking at just are you in a food desert or not without a specific move. But we looked at whether children moved after the first grade into or out of a food desert, and then the effect in second to fourth grades on BMI Z score.
So after the first grade, and what did you find?
That moving into a food desert does have an impact on BMI Z score, and the impact's about 8 standard deviations. And what that means, roughly speaking, is if maybe, you know, someone was at the 60th percentile, you know, they might increase to the 64th percentile. So it doesn't explain the overall growth in childhood obesity. It's not only caused by food deserts. It's not a big enough impact to say this is the culprit. Is it meaningful? I think it is, yes. And is it meaningful economically? Yes. The problem is obesity in general and childhood obesity in particular is just such a complex problem. And that's, you know, something we grapple with all the time. We're looking at a little piece of it. And the work we're doing hopefully will help to prioritize, you know, some of these national and statewide initiatives as to, you know, whether, you know, where policy should be directed and what could be done to maybe help children and families in at-risk areas.
What do you think the priorities are? What do you think should be the first step? Prioritizing what the state legislature can do, or?
Well, in general, there's what policymakers can control, there's what they can't control. You know, ultimately, parents have a big role to play. Families have a big role to play. The work we're doing isn't trying to assign blame or anything else. I mean, our lives are busy. And, you know, I know personally I fall into the same problem. I've got a couple of daughters at home and you know, we've had piano lessons and I've been at work all day. And, gosh, it's sure nice to be able to grab some pizza or something. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with pizza per se. But if we did that all the time,
right,
it wouldn't necessarily be a very healthy diet. So we you know, our lives are so complicated these days. And I think that's probably a big component of it. And so, but there are probably some things that can be done. So, for instance, you know, one of our PhD student who's working on the project with us has looked at the fresh fruit and vegetable program. And what this does is it provides children with a fresh fruit or vegetable experience during the school day. And this program is particularly targeted to low-income schools. And so these would be the kinds of children who may also be in food desert areas. And, you know, our students' work is showing a significant impact. And this is not a very costly program, but it's having an impact. So we can do, I think, these kinds of things. We can be attuned to the food environment and the limitations there, and that may have implications for nutrition assistance programs, SNAP, and other things that are targeting families that may be at risk. And so I don't think we have the answers, unfortunately, but we're working to instruct the answers.
Right. Well, that sounds a lot. I mean, it's education. When you talk about putting, you know, more fruits and vegetables in the low-income schools, and, you know, I mean, they take that home with them, you know, that information home with them, and then in turn can educate their parents.
And you know, my own personal experience is that happens. You know, my older daughter was in a FFVP school for a time here in Fayetteville, and you know, it would just. She would come home and want grape tomatoes or something. And I was like, well, I didn't know you liked those. Oh, yeah, they're great, you know, and it's because they had them at school. And it exposes them to things. And I think it's, you know, I think the schools are a key part, and the school food environment is a key part. And that probably dovetails with the environment around the schools.
What is the takeaway just for the listener, for the general public?
What we found is that I think the food environment makes a difference in relation to childhood obesity, but not to the extent that we can say that it's the main problem. So we found that it can make a difference in terms of influencing childhood obesity, but the magnitude of this influence is not big enough to conclude that it's really one of the major causes of the significant increase in childhood obesity in the last 20 years. But that doesn't say that the food environment is not important. It is important.
It is.
It's just that, as Dr. Thompson mentioned, childhood obesity is a multifaceted, complex issue that that involves not just the environmental factors, but other factors as well.
Michael Thompson and Rudy Niga are agricultural economists at the University of Arkansas. Their project is funded by the USDA National Institute for Food and Agriculture. It's a collaboration with many other organizations around Arkansas. Both Thompson and Niga consider their research work that matters, education that is important to health and policy issue. Their study will appear in the peer-reviewed journal Economics and Human Biology. This is Ozarks at Large. Listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Lick Branch. Lick Branch is in Boone County, just northeast of Alpena. A few events happening at libraries in our area in the next few days. The Bentonville Public Library will host the NWAC Financial Aid Office to present information about FAFSA and federal aid. The informative session will be a great opportunity for teens, parents, or anyone thinking about going to or returning to college. Attendees will have the chance to ask questions and learn more information about the financial side of going to college. The event is this Wednesday at 6 p.m. in the Walmart Community Room at the Bentonville Public Library. It is free and open to the public. For more information about this event or the Bentonville Public Library, visit bentonvillelibrary.org or call 479-271-3192. And in Fayetteville, the Fayetteville Public Library is celebrating Read Across America with a birthday bash for children's author Dr. Seuss. That event is this Saturday, March 1st at 10:30 a.m. in the Children's Library. The party will be complete with magician Tommy Terrific, birthday cake, paint cat whisker faces, and small prizes to all children. Don't be surprised to see the Cat in the Hat at the party. Read Across America is the National Educational Association's annual reading motivation and awareness program. It calls for every child in every community to celebrate reading on March 2nd, the birthday of the beloved children's author Theodore Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss. The program began in 1998 with the idea of getting kids excited about reading and has since grown into the largest celebration of reading in the country with the help of 50 national nonprofit and association partners. Again, this event is March 1st, Saturday at 10:30 a.m. at the Fayetteville Public Library. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Tomorrow, Tuesday, my co-hosts Antoinette Grajeda and Kyle Kellums will be back with an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. This weekend, Georgia's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville announced that the band Slightly Stupid will be making an appearance during their spring tour, April 27th. Slightly Stupid is a fusion band playing a blend of folk, rock, hip-hop, and reggae. So we'll end today's show with Slightly Stupid's song, Closer to the Sun. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good Monday.